this is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell, and joining me in the studio is a new contributor to Indie Media. Kelly, how's it going?
Hi, how's it going?
Thanks very much for coming in. Before we go any further, though, a huge thanks to Jeff for another superb edition of On The Record, giving you all the news and information on your Monday morning. Of course, On The Record will be back tomorrow from 9 a.m. and every weekday here on RTR-FM. But as I said, this is the Indie Media Show. It's all the news and interviews from the open publishing wires of the interwebs. On today's program, we're going to be talking a little bit about an announcement from the federal government to invest a further $1 billion into our Great Barrier Reef, taking the total to a $3 billion investment. It's been welcomed by some because it will mean, improvements to water quality and turtle rehabilitation and so forth. But many people have also criticised the announcement as saying that it's not really going to go far enough to really address the impacts on the reef, particularly given that the greatest impact to the reef is climate change. So a little later in the show, we're going to be speaking to Gavin McFadzean from the Australian Conservation Foundation to find out a little bit about this announcement and perhaps what the federal and state governments could be doing to better protect the reef in regard to taking action on climate change. We're also going to be catching up to talk with Alex Wisson, Indie Media's regular contributor and political editorializer, to talk a little bit about the unfolding situation in Ukraine with escalating tensions between Russia and Ukraine and, of course, an expansion of U.S. hegemony in the region. So we'll be catching up with Alex to chat a bit about that later. That's about all. But I should have said thanks for coming in, Kelly, and becoming a part of Indie Media and everything.
Oh, it's good to be here.
And as we said at the top of the show, there's been an announcement last week of additional funding to protect the Great Barrier Reef from the federal government. An additional $1 billion in funding, making the total to $3 billion in funding to protect the reef. And while this announcement has been welcomed by many, it's also been criticised by conservation groups, saying that the real threat to the reef is climate change and the federal and state governments' lack of action on climate change is really the greatest threat. To find out more, I had an opportunity to speak to Gavin McFadzean from the Australian Conservation Foundation a little earlier today. And I started just by asking Gavin what his response to the funding announcement was.
Oh, well, we welcomed the announcement. I mean, water quality issues are one of the biggest threats facing the Great Barrier Reef and other reef systems around the world. So $1 billion over 9 years to get fertiliser runoff, nutrient runoff, sedimentation as a result of erosion from land clearing for cattle, like getting the water quality improved around the Great Barrier Reef by dealing with some of those land-based impacts that are facing the reef is really important. There was also money for dealing with the crown of thorns starfish, which is a major threat also to the reef, and there's also some money for turtle research to make sure that turtle populations around the reef remain in okay shape. But you're exactly right. Our point was that while improving water quality is really important for reefs such as the Great Barrier Reef, it'll all count for naught unless this government starts taking real action on climate change. Climate change is the number one threat facing the Great Barrier Reef. The science has been really clear on this. If we get to over 1.5 degree increase in global average temperatures, we're about 1.2 now. If we get over 1.5, then reef systems in Australia around the world will die. So there is no amount of improved water quality that will change that fact. So water quality announcements are excellent, but you can't sidestep their climate imperative. And at the moment, the Morrison government is nowhere near where it should be in terms of climate ambition.
Certainly. I guess many of our listeners would be aware of the ongoing impacts of coral bleaching to our Great Barrier Reef and, of course, a lot of our marine ecosystems. But can you give our listeners some idea of what impact has there already been on the Great Barrier Reef as a result of coral bleaching or climate change in general?
Oh, it's been tragic. Since 1998, unfortunately, we've seen now five coral bleaching events in that time, 3 and 5 years during the mid-2010s, kind of in the last 8 years or so. That's killed nearly half the Great Barrier Reef. Some of that is looking to recover, but the Great Barrier Reef is under extreme stress. As a result of warming ocean temperatures caused by climate change and also water quality issues. So the future of the Great Barrier Reef is in very serious threat. It can't be overstated. At this rate, the Great Barrier Reef will die in coming decades unless we take urgent action. And as I said, that water quality announcement by the federal government last week is welcome is an important strand in faith in protecting the Great Barrier Reef for future generations, but it needs to take much more serious action on climate change and getting Australia's emissions down and playing a lead role with neighbours around the world to get global emissions down so that we can protect some of these very fragile ecosystems like the Great Barrier Reef.
Looking at this funding, the United Nations is due to report on the health of the reef next month. They've already indicated that UNESCO indicated last year that the reef is in danger. This was met by a response from our environment minister saying that the UNESCO is ignorant in making the warning. It feels as though this latest round of funding is a bit of sort of saving face without addressing the real issue. Is that your sort of estimation as well? Does it look like the federal government's a little bit caught sort of red-faced in regard to, you know, this great sort of asset with the United Nations saying that our reef's in danger and we're not properly looking after it? Do you think that this funding is really about just sort of saving face and making it look like we're actually doing something?
Well, I think definitely the timing is significant. So this funding may be enough for the Australian government to avoid an in danger listing for the Great Barrier Reef on the eve of a federal election. I don't want to be too cynical, though. I think the announcement is important and it's welcome, but there's no surprise that this announcement's come as UNESCO prepares to look at further reports about the health of the Great Barrier Reef and whether the Great Barrier Reef still meets the values for which it was declared World Heritage in the first place. And secondly, that we have an election, federal election in 4 months' time, and there'd be nothing more embarrassing for the federal government than to have Australia's probably most iconic ecosystem, one of the world's seven natural wonders, declared in danger on the eve of a federal election. So there's no doubt that the federal government definitely had one eye on UNESCO's pending further investigations into the health of the reef, and it had another eye on an upcoming federal election when it made this announcement. But that's to take nothing away from the announcement itself. It was a good announcement, but definitely it's in the context of a federal election not too far away, and UNESCO bringing further scrutiny to the health, protection and management of the Great Barrier Reef.
As you were saying earlier, of course, climate change is a huge threat to the reef. And here in Western Australia, we've just had the Scarborough Gas Hub very much approved and going ahead. We've got the Adani coal mine still seemingly going ahead. And everywhere around the country, it seems as though both federal and state governments are really pushing for an expansion of fossil fuels. As you said there, it is a federal election. Is there any indication at all that any of the parties, with obviously the exception of some of the miners, such as the Greens, any of the parties are really looking to implement policy that would curb emissions, that would address some of the issues around climate change, or is it all just, unfortunately, business as usual?
Well, it's a bit of both. Neither of the major parties, neither Federal, Labor, or the Morrison government, take climate change seriously enough. The Federal Labor policy offering in the lead up to the federal election is definitely a significant improvement on the Morrison government's current offering towards the federal election. So the Morrison government has an emissions reduction target of 26 to 28% by 2030. The Albanese Labor opposition's target is 43%. So it's 15 to 17% more ambitious in terms of getting emissions down. But neither of those targets protects the reef. We need to be well over 50% emissions reduction by 2030 to stay with under that 1.5 degree threshold, which is what the science tells us is required to protect reef ecosystems here and around the world. And we make those choices right now. You simply cannot keep burning coal and gas for domestic power consumption. And Australia is now the largest exporter of coal and gas in the world. You can't keep doing that and expect that reef systems like Ningaloo, like the Great Barrier Reef, will still be here in a generation's time. The science is really clear on this. These are the choices we're making right now. So the federal government and the Albanese opposition is towards heading towards a federal election in May, as to be expected. Both need to lift their game if they're going to take the protection of areas like the Great Barrier Reef seriously enough. I mean, these are some of the most fragile ecosystems in the world. They'll be the most impacted by climate change and the soonest to be impacted. And we need to rapidly transition out of using coal and gas for our electricity system and get onto renewables. That's happening, but it's not happening fast enough. We need to get emissions down in our transport system. So that's electric buses, more people in electric cars and so forth, because transport is building as a big source of Australia's emissions, perhaps the biggest in a few years. So both of the major parties need to take climate action more seriously as we head towards the federal election, although the Albanese opposition's policy offering is a big improvement on what the Morrison government currently offers.
Finally, Gavin, I guess as a result of a lack of action from federal and state governments here in Australia, there has been ongoing campaigns and actions from people, whether it's those involved in the Stop Adani campaign or over here in Western Australia, we've had people take action around, as I mentioned before, the Scarborough Gas Hub. There was also quite some dramatic actions fairly recently with the Blockade Australia groups, where they blocked the coal port in Newcastle and the train line that was starting to shift Adani's coal. Do you foresee more of this kind of community action taking place if there isn't significant change in federal and state politics?
Yeah, I do. And in fact, ACF undertook last year a collaboration with YouGov to look at the growing community concern around climate change and across the country, even in places like regional Queensland, even in seats where coal and gas mining are an economic mainstay, we saw increasing concern about climate change, and a majority of voters in every single seat, including seats where coal is a dominant part of that regional economy, even in those seats, there was over 50% of voters wanted to see stronger action from both of the major parties on climate change. So it's a growing concern. It will be a top three or four election issue at the upcoming federal election. The public's also becoming much more educated and aware about climate impacts and are much more prepared to attribute weather events to climate change in a way that we weren't even seeing a few years ago. So political leaders of both persuasions simply won't be able to get away with spinning their way into trying to convince the public they're taking climate action seriously. People will actually want to see concrete measures to get emissions down. And as I said, that's about replacing coal and gas in our energy system with renewable energy more quickly, about getting emissions down in our transport system, and dealing with issues such as logging and land clearing and getting emissions down by protecting nature, which is also a critical policy in Australia that we need to see more of. So I think we'll see growing concern amongst the Australian public, who's now very literate in the impacts of climate change on Australia's way of life. And I think we'll see increased pressure on both of the major parties to lift their game in the next few months.
And this is the Indie Media Show with myself, Raymond Grenfell, and also Kelly Warden. Now, a Russian foreign ministry official said last Thursday that the U.S. risks provoking a nuclear missile crisis with Moscow unless the U.S. and its NATO allies ensure restraint and predictability in the growing conflict over Ukraine. To discuss this, the heightened tensions and this ongoing conflict between Ukraine, Moscow, and of course the United States, we're now joined by Indie Media contributor and correspondent Alex Wisson. How's it going, Alex?
Yeah, not too bad. Pleasure to be on again, right?
Now, obviously, you know, many of our listeners would be hopefully aware of this this ongoing crisis that, you know, has a deep-rooted history, and I'm sure you can give us some insight into that. Is this as sort of dire as it sounds, and you know, and as serious as it sounds, or is this just much of the same in terms of U.S. and Russian posturing in the region?
I think that the overarching comment there to say is that nobody really knows, which points to the inherent danger of this situation. We've grown used to seeing episodes of brinkmanship in the post-Cold War period involving conflict between the United States and China over the South China Sea and Taiwan, between Russia and the United States over manifold issues, brinkmanship with North Korea. And so I think that in terms of the foreign policy commentariat and journalistic reportage of these sorts of situations, there is an underlying assumption, I think, that it is diplomatic posturing ultimately and gunboat diplomacy. But there is something about this episode that feels different and more dangerous. And I'm loath to make any sorts of predictions, but my own personal perspective and you know, the conclusions of my own analysis is that it is ultimately brinkmanship by Putin, in the sense that there is an element of a sort of forward projection of power by Putin, which is not to contradict what I said the last time I was on, but there is plenty of aggression from the American side. But focusing for a moment on what Putin wants out of this situation, I think ultimately he does not wish to invade Ukraine. I don't think there is a concrete plan at this stage to invade. And actually, everything he said publicly is consistent with what Russia wants out of this situation, namely that they want a guarantee from the United States and their NATO partners that Ukraine will not now or at any point in the future join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And historically, the historical background to that, which has been very much underreported by the Western press, is in the early 1990s, in the immediate wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, Margaret Thatcher, this is quite a famous sort of diplomatic incident, actually. It was never written down on paper, and it's sort of lost to the mists of time in some ways. But the story has always been that Margaret Thatcher and other Western politicians at the time gave a guarantee to the Russians that NATO would not expand to the Russian border. Now, of course, that's not what happened. The United States, Britain and its allies broke that promise of the early 1990s. NATO has continued its march eastwards right to the border with Russia. The Baltic states, Poland, the Czech Republic and so on, all member states. So Russia's concern here is that Ukraine is a step too far. It is contiguous with Russia. We discussed the last time I was on the show about the strategic importance of Ukraine in terms of geographically, in terms of its Black Sea location, the Sevastopol, the Blue Water access point for the Russian Navy. There's wider issues in terms of the United States' design, possibly on Crimea, which listeners may know that Russia annexed Crimea in 2014 following the political crisis in Ukraine. There's concerns as well over the Russian-speaking population in Luhansk and Donetsk. Now, and it's worth spending a little bit of time talking about that, because really the way that's covered in the Western press is it's dismissed in toto that there are any kind of legitimate grievances for that Russian-speaking population. We can debate whether the level at which there's Russian interference and manipulation of the people in Donetsk and Luhansk in the Donbass region of eastern Ukraine. But historically and culturally and ethnically, these are Russian-speaking people. Some of them are actually Russians. A lot of them are Russian-speaking Ukrainians. And there has been, and I don't wish to overstate it in terms of the scale of the oppression, but there certainly has been an effort by the Ukrainian government post-2014 mm-hmm. to, for instance, limit the use of Russian language in schools, in the equivalent of our primary schools and middle schools and so on, and to reassert a kind of a Ukrainian national identity rooted in the Ukrainian language, which has left a lot of Russian-speaking Ukrainians in the East feeling alienated, disenfranchised and, sort of under threat from the central government in Kiev. And so I would say that there were legitimate grievances there, which is precisely part of the reason why a lot of people in the region were willing to side with Russia and indeed sign up to and take up arms with these Russian-backed militias. Now, a lot of those grievances were supposed to have been settled by the Minsk agreement. There were actually two agreements that led to a fragile ceasefire on the front lines of eastern Ukraine, the Minsk, so-called Minsk 1 and Minsk 2 agreements, part of which was actually respecting and recognising the autonomy of the Luhansk and Donetsk People's Republics. The Kiev government agreed to that. They've since reneged on those agreements by continuing to engage in war. And let's not forget that there is an ongoing actual war in eastern Ukraine, casualties on both sides. And part of the premise of that ongoing conflict is Ukraine's refusal to recognise the autonomous rights of the people of Luhansk and Donetsk. So all of that is to say, we've covered this the last time I was on the show, there are legitimate questions and grievances for the Russian side. And yet, as we've discussed, and really everything I said the last time I was on the show has been borne out and vindicated by everything that's happened in the month since, that almost none of this is discussed by the Western press, and it's all uniformly painted as a picture of Russian aggression. Coming back to the pressing question of will there be an invasion, again, I don't think there will be. But suffice it to say, there's also been further developments in terms of upping the ante of aggression on the Western side. So there are British soldiers that, as we speak, are being sent to Ukraine to bolster their training capacity of the Ukrainian armed forces. Biden, just a few days ago, has said that he is going to redeploy, he didn't specify, but likely combat brigades to certain parts of Eastern Europe to bolster the presence of American forces in Eastern Europe. There's a continuing supply of anti-tank weaponry, anti-tank missiles to Ukraine, and a measure of the United States aggression in this situation is that even the Kiev government, Vladimir Zelensky, has said that there is hysteria in the West. The Ukrainian government itself has said that and has opposed, for instance, the withdrawal of diplomatic missions or the families of diplomats in Kiev. The Australian embassy, for instance, has evacuated family members. And that is being seen as a hysterical response within Ukraine itself. So that tells you something about the nature of what's going on, that ostensibly the Australian government sort of is more fearful of an invasion than the Ukrainian government itself. And so the question has to be asked, what countries like the US and Australia hope to gain from this situation? And it's not entirely clear, I have to say, what they hope to gain from it. Clearly, they want to see in the longer term Ukraine join NATO. But you have to ask the question of, is it at what price? At what price will that NATO membership cost for the Western Alliance? Because as much as we might predict or conclude that this is brinkmanship and ultimately won't be war, history has a way of showing us that episodes of brinkmanship do indeed sometimes lead to war. And the provocations from the Western NATO alliance unquestionably have an inherent danger to them, and such the situation could very quickly escalate out of control.
Just quickly there, Alex, I mean, back in 2013, during Maidan and the uprising and the revolution, I guess there were many
different perspectives from people on the left in terms of whether or not to support the revolution or support these sorts of, independence movements that were popularized during the time. There were some, of course, very nasty elements to that movement, including groups such as the Right Sector and so forth. Since then, it is clear, as this situation is demonstrating, that, of course, the Ukrainian government is really a neoliberal somewhat puppet of the US. But as you're indicating there, the relationship is somewhat complicated. You've already in part answered this, but to what extent is it imperative for the US to have really a base of operations out of the Ukraine, to have the Ukraine join NATO? How significant is it in terms of their geopolitical machinations presently to ensure that they really have a foothold in the Ukraine? And therefore, I guess in that sense, it sort of answers to what extent, how far will they go to ensure that the Ukraine join NATO?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question, and it speaks to the difference between the formalities or the appearances, the political surface, and the reality underneath. And what I mean by that is that in a lot of these East European states, they are formally allied with the West in many ways and have trade relationships, but in many ways are being pushed towards the Russian side. And that was really the chief concern with Russia. With Ukraine. It had a pro-Russian government up until 2013, as you said, until the government was overthrown in the Maidan protests. And really ever since, there has been a continuing sort of underlying stability. I mean, there's actually a populist a prime minister in power. That's strangely a strange story, actually, Zelensky, who he played a populist prime minister in a comedy show. He was opposed to all of the establishment parties in Ukraine. He then ended up being a populist politician who actually became a prime minister in real life, ostensibly opposed to the establishment parties. And he's sort of one of these strange, sort of populist figures we're seeing popping up all throughout the Western world. And it's not entirely clear that he's absolutely 100% in the pockets of the United States. So there is a concern there, I think, as well, about a lot of this has to do placing into a corner the Ukrainian government, so it's forced to choose sides, really. Not to say that Zelensky is somehow an honourable politician or principled politician, he's shown no evidence of that, and I think ultimately his allegiances will lie with whatever is most politically beneficial to him. But we've also seen protests in Belarus, for instance, with dozens of people killed. There's protests in Kazakhstan. There's an ongoing kind of tug of war with a lot of these protest movements, and in terms of the political establishment, about, as I say, where those allegiances lie. This is the traditional Russian sphere of influence, but I have no proof of this, and I have to be careful about speculating too much. But one has to ask that some of these protests, for instance, why are they suddenly getting the kind of press coverage we've seen? Who are the forces behind some of these protests? Because I think too often, actually, the left makes the mistake of assuming that these are genuine grassroots movements, and perhaps they are. Perhaps they have elements of a grassroots movement. But one would be foolish to not recognise that in countries like Belarus, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, a lot of political interference is happening as well. We've seen talk of so-called Russian intelligence agents going in putting in placemen for some kind of a coup, possibly in Kiev. Suffice it to say, the West is just as capable of that kind of political interference as well. And it's kind of an obvious thing to say, but it's one of those things that's worth stressing as well, that who are really ultimately going to be the losers in this whole conflict? It's the ordinary people of Russia and Ukraine. It's ordinary working class people who, if it comes to war, will be thrust into the front line and put it through the meat grinder of an inter-imperialist war, which could be very brutal and bloody for both sides.
Alex Whitson, thank you so much for speaking to us this morning.
You are, and hopefully the next time we discuss that it's not a grave development, and so we'll have to wait and see what happens, but certainly it remains a very dangerous situation.
Indeed. You're on the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. We're just speaking to Alex Whitson, regular Indie Media contributor and co-host, updating us on the ongoing situation in the Ukraine.